This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's son. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Welcome. The title of tonight's installment is Race and Genetics, Part 4. The subtitle could be Fritz Lenz and the Jewish Fondness for Lamarckism, which is really the Jewish fondness for anti-racism or the Jewish fondness for pro-Jewish chauvinism. And we're going to make a transition here, as history did, from a series of forthright and genius white men who were getting at the biological roots of race through science, from Boyle to Lamarck to Darwin to Wallace to Galton to Spencer to Mendel, Weissmann, and I'm going to get into a few more here, to an era in which Jews are beginning to participate and ultimately prevail and today dominate the discourse on race and how race is perceived. And the strong contrast is what I want to call attention to here between those two views. And I started, or I finished up last time talking about Fritz Lenz and racial hygiene in National Socialist Germany. And I think I got a bit ahead of myself there. I want to take a step back and mention Ernst Haeckel, who was a German scientist, an eminent German biologist, naturalist, philosopher, physician, professor, and artist, who discovered, described, and named thousands of new species, mapped a genealogical tree relating all life forms, and coined many terms in biology. That's from Wikipedia. He was born in 1834 and died in 1919. This is one of the men who's cited as a scientific racist. I mention him tonight because I'm going to trace tonight the specifically German roots of race science and make note of the fact that the men until now have been Germans and Anglos and the odd Frenchman in there as well, but basically of the Nordic race, Northern Europeans, Aryans. Haeckel was an inspiration to many people, but particularly to a man named Alfred Ploetz, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. That's how it seems to be spelled, anyway. Alfred Ploetz was born in 1860 and lived until 1940, again, according to a Wikipedia article. He was a German physician, biologist, eugenicist, known for coining the term racial hygiene. So he's the man who originated that term and for promoting it, the concept in Germany. And it mentions that race hygiene is a form of eugenics. And you can think of it that way. I've seen some mentions of it that basically equate the two. They consider them synonymous. I found a reference here to Alfred Ploetz and race hygiene at the National Socialist Worldview blog, which is run by Hanning Scott, who does some work here at the White Network on the International Jew Study Hour with Carolyn Jaeger. And he has translated the introduction to Alfred Ploetz's 1895 work in which he introduces the term race hygiene. Racial hygiene. And he cites, Hanning Scott cites Robert Proctor as being the one who has credited Ploetz for that coining that term. I want to quote a paragraph here from the introduction of Plowitz's book, of his work, explaining what racial hygiene is, justifying the term. He writes, peoples and races are just organic life forms determined like beasts and plants through their component parts, cells here, men there, for which their environment is a complex of favorable or unfavorable conditions. And just as we have, by the combination of favorable conditions, created a hygiene for man, which, based ultimately on the life of his cells, teaches him how he may maintain health as long as possible and postpone based on the vital functions of men, to attempt the founding of a hygiene of the races and of all mankind, which teaches how an organic collectivity of men may keep itself as vigorous as possible and postpone its perishing as long as possible. Plowitz goes on to explain his view of race, which corresponds very much to what I've been describing all along as a range of human groupings. And that passage right there that I just read, he describes it basically as an organic collectivity of men. But that's the most generic way of describing the idea of race. And he actually specifically describes both the continental sense as one meaning of race and also the finer national groupings, the national sense of the term. Plowitz is important because he was a mentor directly to Lentz, not just an influence, but knew him and influenced Lentz's thinking and worked with him. One of the points I want to drive home in this installment is how Lentz and these other white biologists and their thinking about race was very forthright. They were, as far as they were concerned, you know, discovering the mechanisms of nature. And although they were, they favored their own group as a general rule, they tried to think objectively about what they were doing and be fair-minded about it. I think that comes through in Plowitz's description of racial hygiene, which, if you're like me, all you had ever heard about racial hygiene before was sort of boogeyman type of imagery about how it's the worst thing in the world and you know, almost caused the destruction of the human race in World War II. And we'll get a little bit into that as we go on here. Lentz is famous really for his two-volume textbook published in 1921 with Eugen Fischer and Erwin Bauer, which I think the title was An Outline of Human Genetics and Racial Hygiene, or at least that's what the subject of it was. And Proctor describes it as this is Proctor writing in 1988 now, retrospectively, as a monument of scholarship and careful argumentation. And it strongly influenced German biomedical thinking and provided scientific legitimacy for many of the views that came to be favored in the Nazi era. The book remained the most prestigious genetics textbook of Germany for more than 20 years. And his co-author, Lentz's co-author, Bauer, was known as, quote, the founder of human genetics in Germany. So I finished last time citing a particular paragraph of Proctor's talking about Lentz's rejection of Lamarckian inheritance and that it was part of a broader rejection by racial hygienists of, quote, any substantial role for the environment in shaping human behavior and social institutions, and how environmentalism could only be upheld on ideological, not scientific grounds. And I pulled that one out in particular because although Proctor gives a pretty straight-up description of Lentz and racial hygiene, is a good example of the distortions, the kind of distortions that we see in today's description of race science. And the painting of Lentz as being biased and seeing no substantial role for the environment, and that environmentalism was purely ideological and not scientific, this is a bit of projection of its distortion, its exaggeration, and it's a projection of an inversion of what is actually the belief today, the exact opposite, that the rejection of any substantial role for genetics in shaping human behavior and social institutions. That's racism. And that is a purely ideological thing, and that there's no scientific basis whatsoever to race. That's the prevailing wisdom or stupidity of today. Now, another bit here I'd like to quote a Proctor talking about Lenz. He repeatedly poked fun, he's talking about Lenz here, he repeatedly poked fun at Soviet attempts to politicize genetics by identifying the doctrine of the inheritance of acquired characteristics, he's talking about Lamarckism, with socialist or proletarian science. Science, according to Lenz, was value-free, and politics must not play a role in its development. He's trying to be objective. Science, however, could and should inform the practice of politics. In 1930, in his celebration of Plowitz's 70th birthday, Lenz wrote, "Plowitz recognized as unsatisfactory from the very beginning the Marxist doctrine of historical materialism, a doctrine which, biologically speaking, derived from the principle of the omnipotence of the environment," like today's prevailing stupidity, that the it's all about the environment and genetics is insignificant in its contribution or nothing. Lenz goes on, "The recognition that not all evil is determined by the environment and that the roots of most evil lie instead in hereditary defects became the motivating force in racial hygiene." So right there, Lenz says very clearly, and this is Proctor quoting him, that not all evil is determined by the environment and that the roots of most of it is in hereditary defects. So Lenz doesn't take the extreme view that it's all hereditary, it's all genetics, and that it's not the environment at all. Lenz is simply saying that it's a little bit of, or some of both, and he does say it's mostly hereditary, he believes. In the concluding chapter of the 1927 edition of his two-volume textbook, which is titled The Inheritance of Particular Talents, he's talking here, he describes mental characteristics. And he begins the chapter with a series of questions that sound very reasonable. Why is it that many persons are able, many others are stupid, and the majority are mediocre? Why are some people cheerful and others gloomy, some industrious and others slothful, some unselfish and others selfish? He goes on to write about how he thinks that the attributes of Negro cruelty, he attributes it to a childlike lack of human sympathy and self-restraint. And he claims that the Mongol, by whom he means Orientals, what we would call today Orientals or Asians, greatly exceeds the Nordic man in mental development, but their memory is stronger than their intellect, and that they have more capacity for imitation than for invention. He also talks about the Alpine and Mediterranean races of Europe, making distinctions between different races in Europe. This seems to confuse Proctor, or Proctor presents this as something scandalous. And he goes on to say, this is Proctor writing now, "His most extraordinary remarks, however, are those concerning the Jews, whom he classifies, along with Greeks and Armenians, as belonging to the, quote, Near Eastern race, unquote. Much of what he says about Jews represents an attempt to explain in biological terms Jewish desires to assimilate to German culture. According to Lenz, Jews can be recognized at once by their appearance, though the mental particulars of this race are even more distinctive than the physical." Parenthetically, he adds, he refers to the Jews as, quote, a mental race. Lenz imagines himself able to recognize, well, quote, "to recognize the literary work of a Jew, scientific writing included, by the way in which the thoughts are developed and by the method of expression," unquote, and then proceeds to list a wide range of examples for this thesis. Now, here, Proctor is being very sarcastic or skeptical, you know, qualifying these statements as, you know, clearly attributing them to Lenz and not to himself, and Lenz imagines that he can tell who's a Jew and who isn't, and that he can do it by thinking. And this is really bizarre, because of course it's true that at least in some cases you can tell who's a Jew just by looking at them, and sometimes you can tell by their thoughts and by the way they express themselves. In fact, the Jews recognize this as well. They have an expression, two expressions. One they call Judischkopf, meaning a Jewish head or a Jewish way of thinking, and another, which is an insult, called the Goyischkopf, meaning, you know, Goyim, a non-Jewish way of thinking, a non-Jewish head. These expressions existed long before racial hygiene, as far as I'm aware. Many Jews, Lenz reports, this is Proctor writing again about Lenz, in the process of adapting to essentially alien surroundings, have tried to imitate the customs and appearance of their hosts in order to blend in and appear less conspicuous. He considers this a typical case of, quote, animal mimicry, unquote, commonly observed, quote, wherever a living creature gains advantages in the struggle for existence by acquiring a resemblance to some other organism, unquote. It is for this reason, he argues, that the Jews are not just shrewd and alert, not just diligent and persevering, but possess as well an unusual sense of empathy. I wouldn't even call it empathy, actually. But that's just me. An ability to put themselves in the place of others and to induce others to accept their guidance. The Near Easterner in general, and the Jew in particular, has been selected not for the control and exploitation of nature, but for the control and exploitation of other men. I think this is a very important point. And again, it's fairly clear that it's true. It's not just Lenz's paranoid mind that imagines this. This was this idea of mimicry is really and struggle for survival is really just a logical extension of the things that biologists had been noticing in the struggle for life in general, and how different types, forms of life, different species survived or didn't. And this idea that Jews are controlling and manipulative by their nature, and that they do this to other men, this is something that was mentioned in one of the last two installments of the International Jew Study Hour. In the International Jew, the observation was made that where, as European men may farm the soil, Jews prefer to farm and do farm people themselves. I'm putting it kind of crudely and paraphrasing. I don't recall the exact quote there. Lenz is, even just reading between the lines here or factoring out Proctor's skepticism and disdain for him, is the one who's being empathetic here. He is actually trying very hard to be fair and charitable to the Jews. And there are other places in the book and in other writings about Lenz that describe his hostility to anti-Semites and his favorable views of the Jews. This is in contrast, in strong contrast, to Jews themselves. This is one of the ways that they distinguish themselves mentally from other European peoples, from white peoples. And that is that Jews are not at all charitable or understanding of anyone that they regard as an opponent, as anyone who recognizes them as a separate, distinct group, as not them, as the other. And this is one of many markers that typify Jewish thinking, this loathing and disgust that they express this freely for the people that they perceive as enemies. And I'd like to cite here the work of a man named, a Jew named Raphael Patai. He wrote a book called The Jewish Mind. And he also cites Lenz and talks about Lenz. He also used the expression, the Jewish fondness for Lamarckism, that first made me discover it along with Proctor's book. The Jewish mind, interestingly enough, the whole thesis is that the Jews do have noticeable intellectual patterns that, you know, Patai is an apologist for the Jews. He is described as a Hungarian Jewish ethnographer, historian, Orientalist, and anthropologist, not a hard scientist, not a biologist or really fit to shine the shoes of any of the men I've mentioned so far. He wrote his book and published his book in 1977. And this is sort of the duality that we see of a good example of it, where Proctor presents this idea that the Jews are a mental race as if it's kooky. And here's a Jew, this fellow Patai, talking about the Jewish mind, that he doesn't use the same terms. He doesn't call them a mental race. In fact, in the introduction to The Jewish Mind, he talks about how this book is an outshoot of an earlier book he wrote with his daughter called The Myth of the Jewish Race. And that was the point of that book, was to basically poo-poo the whole idea that the Jews are a race. Typically, he writes in the very introduction to that book, quote, "The systematic extermination of 6 million Jews by Nazi Germany and its satellites was the culmination of the notion that the Jews were a race with distinct inherited physical and mental characteristics, alien to the Gentile population in whose midst they lived, and overtly or secretly inimical to it. Modern European racial anti-Semitism, which in the years of World War II led to the largest genocide ever perpetrated, is a special subvariety of a generic phenomenon known as racism, which was characterized by Ashley Montagu as, quote, a malfunctioning of the mind which endangers human relations, a disease due to the infection of the mind by false ideas concerning the status of other groups of human beings, unquote. What Patai is expressing here in this paragraph, in his introduction to his book about the myth of the Jewish race, is that the whole idea that, well, first of all, let me say that this is the prevailing conventional stupidity of today. This is how everybody who's right thinking is supposed to view race, that it's bad, evil, and it's a disease. I mean, they literally pathologize it here. His description is based on Ashley Montagu, and I'll get into him in subsequent installments. It's literally a disease. It's a malfunctioning of the brain. As I've said before, that racists, when somebody calls you a racist, they're basically telling you that you're mentally or morally defective, and you're subhuman. Effectively, it's a projection. It's an inversion, of their description of racists as subhumans, effectively, that think that other people are subhumans. It's basically flipping it around. This introduction goes on. "The most frightening thing about racism was, and is, that once its virus lodges in the mind, it dims perception to the degree of making all persons appear not primarily as individual human beings, but as members of a race. If an individual is perceived as belonging to a different race, he is stereotyped as an alien, almost like a creature from another galaxy in modern science fiction, and as such, an enemy whose capture, enslavement, immobilization, or murder lies in our interest. To the diseased racist mind, there is, therefore, no such thing as mankind. There are only disparate races, which, whenever they encounter one another, are destined to enter into a deadly struggle whose foreordained outcome is the victory of the master race." This is a complete distortion. Of course, if you've been following me in these previous installments, the people who are cited as these horrible scientific racists are amongst the most intelligent men the human race has ever produced, and I say the human race as a whole. They're also amongst the brightest lights of the white race. And they didn't think these things. This is a distortion of what they thought. This is a boogeyman mischaracterization of it. This fellow Patai is projecting his own dirty thinking onto these white men. And I think he's conscious of it, too. I think that this is one of the ways that the Jewish mind works, is they completely exaggerate and they distort. And if they think lying is in the best interest of the Jews, then they lie blatantly if they need to. And that was the point of his first paragraph, was to spell out that race science led to something that he thinks was bad for the Jews, and therefore race science is bad. It doesn't matter whether it's factual or whether these men were just following what they could observe in nature. It doesn't matter if it's true. It's bad because it's bad for Jews. At least that's the Jewish point of view on it. Now, in his book about the Jewish mind, he writes very favorably about Jews as a separate group. He starts his book in the introduction, "Were we to set the peoples of the world in a series ranging from those who had the least exposure to outside influences to those who had the most, the Jews would undoubtedly rank the highest in the variety, intensity, and duration of such exposure. More than that, the difference in this respect between the Jews and the Gentiles is not merely quantitative, but also qualitative. This, in effect, places the Jewish people in a category sui generis, which means it's Latin for of its own kind, its own genus, literally. Thus, history has supplied a profound justification for the taxonomical dichotomy of mankind into Jews and Gentiles, which has been a fundamental feature of the Jewish worldview ever since antiquity. When the Bible put the prophetic words about Israel into the mouth of a pagan seer, Balaam, quote, 'Lo, it is a people that shall dwell alone and shall not be reckoned among the nations.'" This, what he says here, is that the Jewish worldview since antiquity is that Jews are a distinct, unique, special, superior to everyone else people. And this, of course, is just normal and natural and positive. It's not a diseased racist mind that's saying this, according to Patai. And this is the contrast that we see over and over and over again in any Jewish explication of the world around us. When they're not talking to other Jews, they're basically not being honest. They're, in this case, he's writing a book that's favorable to the Jews. Of course, the Jews aren't dirty, diseased, racist thinkers. They just have a wonderful mind, and they are distinct and unique, even as he's telling us that they're a separate group. He goes on, when he's talking about Lentz later on in his book, this Jew Patai, to write, "Lentz's attitude to the, quote, Jewish race was unsympathetic but correct. Despite his nationalistic conceit, Lentz was a serious scholar whose work represented the best of German science, that German science produced until his time in genetics. Lentz even goes so far in his presentation of the similarity between Jews and Germans that he attributes to it the, quote, frequent outbreaks of enmity between Germans and Jews," which Patai inserts now, "read, the frequent anti-Semitic attacks by Germans against Jews." He couldn't resist inserting that, his own biased view of it. Here's Lentz trying to be fair and objective, seeing it as a mutual enmity between Germans and Jews. And of course, Patai has to make it all the Germans' fault. "It is the similarity of in their respective gifts which leads to a strong competition." This is Lentz's view. "Like that which has again and again led to the ruling groups of the Teutons into conflict with one another, each striving to establish power over the others." Here's Lentz equating Jews to other Teutons. There's no hint here of superiority. Well, I'm out of time for this week. I'll finish up. I have some more thoughts on this that I'll provide you next time. Please join me.